From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We are so thankful for your support. We need that support. We need your encouragement. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Thursday is the Hindu observance of Krishna Janmashtami. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, days after the daylight murder of a beloved Brooklyn imam and his assistant, a man was shot dead by a neighbor in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The victim's family says law enforcement ignored complaints that the killer had been harassing the victim, who was Christian, but whom the neighbor vilified as Muslim for years. 2015 saw a surge in religious intolerance across the globe, according to a new report from the U.S. State Department. The newly released International Religious Freedom Report identifies a growing number of hotspots where discrimination and even violence based on religion or non-religion are relevant. A group of pastors in Illinois has filed suit to reverse a state law forbidding ex-gay therapy for young people. Not surprisingly, the pastors are using religious liberty as their rationale. And on a personal note, Donna Redwing, once branded the most dangerous woman in America by the Christian Coalition, this week announced her retirement as head of One Iowa, the state's leading LGBT advocacy organization. Donna's decades of activism for equality and interreligious cooperation, including time as chief of staff at Interfaith Alliance. And so I want to wish Donna all the best, although I am skeptical that she'll be able to do much retiring. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Donald Trump to meet with hundreds of conservative pastors at a private meeting in Florida. The meeting is sponsored by the American Renewal Project. The group's founder, David Lane, recently spoke about the perils of homosexual totalitarianism.
Donald and the Dominionist. Perhaps it wasn't the most controversial thing candidate Trump has done in recent weeks, but his starring role at a far-right Christian conservative gathering in Orlando, Florida, titled Rediscovering God in America, should not be ignored. For a reminder about what the shadowy organizers, David Lane and his American Renewal Project, would like to see changed about our democracy, I'll talk to Political Research Associate Senior Fellow Fred Clarkson.
We plan to put hands to our heartbeat. Our goal is to accelerate our working together across the racial, regional, and theological lines.
Former President Jimmy Carter launched the New Baptist Covenant for Racial Reconciliation almost 10 years ago. In the face of increased tensions over race, however, this year Carter has urged greater involvement on the part of more churches nationwide. On this week's show, I'll talk with the Reverend Trey Lyons from Park Avenue Baptist Church and the Reverend Michael Wortham from Ebenezer Baptist Church, both in Atlanta, Georgia, prominent congregations that are deeply involved in this inspiring work. But first,
an imam murdered, shot in the head in Queens.
There are voices all over this country who are spewing hate, trying to turn one American against another.
I'm scared. I don't go outside right now, especially at nighttime.
It was chilling to read the headlines about the death of a beloved Muslim leader, a faith leader and his assistant, in broad daylight on the streets of New York City this past week. While the specifics of this tragedy are unique, the fear it inspired is much more universal, and sadly, nothing new for Muslim Americans. Joining me now is Kabir Chidhari, president of the nearby Masjid al-Aman Mosque. Mr. Chidhari, our condolences to you on your loss and our gratitude for agreeing to be with us today on State of Belief Radio at this critical time.
Thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate your solidarity.
I want to ask you, if it's okay, to talk about Imam Malami Akinji and his work at the El Furqan Jami Majid Mosque.
He was a wonderful human being. He immigrated just a few years ago. The position of an imam in this mosque was his second position. He's a very, very humble, dedicated man of faith. He preached life of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam to unite people and to guide people in a spiritual direction where people will end up in a better position in life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a family man, a good father, a wonderful husband. And anybody who knew him would be shocked to know that he has any enemies or adversaries or anybody has ever confronted him with anything or even argued.
Mm.
He was that type of a man who, you know, you would admire.
Mr. Chaudhuri, help our listeners to understand the nature of the Muslim community there. Many people are from Bangladesh, is that correct?
Correct, yes. Most every Muslims, which is part of our congregations in the mosque around the area, are predominantly from Bangladesh.
And tell us a little bit about the makeup of the congregation and the spirit of it, that kind of description.
Our way of life is masjid-centric. People in our mosque, which is one of the bigger mosques in the area, we have 500-600 people participating in five times prayer. For you to have 500-600 people participating, you know, you imagine how many thousands of people live in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, any community activities, any announcements, any kind of good news or bad, it's usually announced from the mosque, and that's how people are informed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very unique place where people come because, you know, we are new immigrants here. We are a minority. So when we come to our place of worship, it's a sense of tranquility and peace and a feeling that you are at the right place.
Mm-hmm.
That's why these mosques are busy and doing a great job serving its congregants and the communities it's situated at.
Typically, how often during the week would the community gather for worship or for education or to be together?
Well, it's five times a day for daily prayer. Then we have Friday afternoon prayer where you have thousands of people participate.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have, you know, youth programs. We have community activities for senior adults. We have educational program for, you know, youth adult women, and different activities just to keep everybody on the same page, educate them with the target of letting everybody know that we are here for a brief period of time. We got to prepare for the life after death.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just constant reminder every day or every opportunity this mosque have to do so.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of the political rhetoric we've been hearing all this year has caused many Muslims to feel more fearful and unsafe. Many of my Muslim friends have told me that it's been a very different feeling in their respective communities because of a lot of the hate speech that has been about. Would you talk about how these murders add to that fear?
Absolutely. You know, you could only be careful and do things cautiously. But when you have people that are, you know, up there capable of being the highest position holder of the country, when they utter rhetoric that are extreme and that are fearful and that are dividing statements, you know, that's something ordinary people of any community, any minority, whether, you know, you are Muslim, Jew, Black, Latino, it's very hard to get hold of and get controlled. And people, when they hear this rhetoric, they're also confused, I think, to a point where they don't know how to act or how to deal with this kind of nonsense they hear. And some people, unfortunately, take it on their own hands and their judgment and go out there and act the way they do irresponsibly. we are ultimately the victim of this kind of situation. I think the politicians have a lot to contribute to this kind of rhetoric when and if they're not careful in what they're saying.
What happens when murders like this take place? What happens to the children in your mosque?
You know, children are lost. I have 5 children of my own.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they'll hear me talk on the phone or sometimes even giving an interview. They're like, you know, who died, who killed, police killed. You know, they don't know.
Uh-huh.
And our parents have told us, when you walk on the street, look on the front, look right, look left. But now this killer has killed these 2 innocent men
mm-hmm.
from the back, point blank, at very close proximity.
Yeah.
How do you walk around on the street, you or your children, going to a mosque or anywhere, and be careful when you know you have to also look at the back?
Uh-huh.
It's been very, very hard, and it's just a different thing that happened.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how we would fully prepare for these things so it doesn't happen again. I just think it's very hard to walk when you have to also look in the back of your head. You don't have 2 extra set of eyes. You know, God didn't treat us that way.
I know the depth of devotion that exists in the Muslim community, the importance of gathering at the mosques, the essential nature of saying the prayers. After these murders, when this kind of thing happens, do members of the mosque, do they tend to stay home? Are they courageous in coming to be together? How does it affect the mosque as a whole?
The first few days, I believe it was people who have just moved here a couple of years ago, not familiar with the culture. You know, they're sort of shocked and intimidated all the time anyway. But
mm-hmm.
when they hear something like this, that just because you look like a Muslim and you were killed, many people have stayed home.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, they're concerned and curious and very anxious in the same time to find out what actually happened to these 2 brothers. And they
sure.
also feel like it's a great responsibility on their part to also help out and participate to get justice.
Yeah.
So I think even with this mixed feeling and emotion, people were still out there coming out bravely to demonstrate, to speak their mind, and to express how they feel and how angry they were. I believe not many people stayed home, even though they were fearful of their life.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chaudhary, for the leaders in your mosque, not just those who do the programs, but those who are key members of the mosque and are leaders in many different ways in the spirituality of the Muslim community, what are you all telling the Muslim American community? What are you saying to members of your own mosque about really how to continue daily life in this kind of climate?
I think one and most importantly, we are telling everybody to stay united, stay vigilant, and stay dedicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think simultaneously what the leadership has to increase, I believe that there is some lacking on our part also to commingle and introduce ourselves to the outer communities, including the faith-based socio-political organizations, and maybe even different, culture and religious groups that we are neighbored with.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to expand the prophetic way of being with your neighbors and coexisting, peace and harmony. We need to follow a little bit more of the teachings of our prophet and start expanding ourselves further so that the difference fades away and the similarities come to the front. And as human beings with our own beliefs, we could still coexist in peace and love and harmony. And
mm-hmm.
that would take time, but we have to. We cannot wait anymore. We cannot wait for more lives to be sacrificed. We have to start our work, sooner than later. And I think it started already.
Mr. Chaudhary, how has this tragedy, these 2 deaths, affected you personally?
I think it affected everything I had dreamed and believed. And I think it kind of crushed what you think you have overcome. You know, these things used to happen 15, 20 years ago. We were very new in this culture. You know, other communities would look at us differently, like, you know what, why are they occupying our places? And you know, kind of territorial thoughts. But now, being a contributor to the community, being educated here, and trying to do your part to become an American with all aspects, I thought we have come a long way. And especially in New York, things like this would not happen. Mm-hmm. But it did happen, and it happened in the worst possible way. So it takes me either go back to 20 years ago, or a time where, you know, I never thought existed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we cannot be caught with this and be dysfunctional. I think life has to go on, and our purpose of this world is much greater than be scared. So we've got to be out there with more confidence and faith, and you know, make more friends, and maybe convert the enemies into friends, and it's just a greater challenge, but we've got to take it.
What are the things that our listeners can be doing right now to be supportive allies with Muslim Americans?
I would like all our faith-based organizations, community leaders, and members, neighbors, just to support us in mental way, where we feel that they're there, we're not alone. And we are minorities, we are Muslims, we are immigrants. We could use any help from any direction. And I think God will allow others to have it in their heart to be kind and neighborly and friendly to us. So we go through this tough time and build a better relationship with all our neighbors, friends, and faith-based organizations. And again, all of our purpose is to be peaceful and exist in peace and live a simpler life that are, you know, peaceful and harmonious.
Kabir Shahadhuri is president of the Masjid Al-Aman Mosque in Brooklyn, New York. He was a friend and colleague of Imam Maulana Akhundji, who was gunned down along with his assistant in broad daylight last week. Mr. Shahadhuri, I can't thank you enough for agreeing to talk with us during such a difficult time. It is good for our nation to have a person like you in it and to speak so compassionately and so eloquently about the importance of all of us coming together. Our best wishes to you and to your community.
Thank you very much, and I would request all of you to keep us in your prayers.
It was back in 2007 that President Jimmy Carter announced the formation of a bold new initiative for faith-driven racial reconciliation called the New Baptist Covenant. This year, the former president has expressed alarm at the growing racial tensions we've been seeing in this country and has been actively working to grow the covenant active in a small number of cities since its founding. I'm very pleased to be joined now by the Reverend Trey Lyons from Park Avenue Baptist Church and the Reverend Michael Wortham from Ebenezer Baptist Church, both located in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to State of Belief, both of you.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for having us, yeah. Dr. Gaddy. Glad to be on.
Reverend Wortham, let me begin with you. You serve a historic congregation. Ebenezer Baptist was pastored, as most people know, by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., as well as his father. With such a legacy, what led you to take the step to take part in the New Baptist Covenant?
Well, we see work with the New Baptist Covenant as an opportunity to really continue the work that not only Dr. King but others before him is really trying to help our country become a more perfect union. And a lot of that deals with being able to overcome this big hurdle that we have in our country, seemingly, that we call racism. And so being able to be active in helping eradicate this sin in a lot of respects that's caused a lot of damage mm-hmm. in our country to everyone, not only black people, but to white people, Hispanic people, all persons who constitute and make this nation. And so trying to find ways as within our denomination to say that how we're going to do what God's called us to do, and that's to love God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength, love our neighbors, we love ourselves. And so mm-hmm. Ebenezer is one the church has always stood on the side of justice and stood on behalf of justice and figuring that this is something that's a great opportunity to say how we can connect as a Baptist congregation and be able to connect with our other Baptist brothers and sisters and lead the charge in showing what the beloved community can look like.
Hmm. Reverend Lyons, let me ask you the same question. Why did Park Avenue Baptist get involved in the covenant?
Yeah, so an interesting part of Park Avenue's history actually is a sort of relationship with Ebenezer over the years. And I use that term somewhat loosely. And so the New Baptist Covenant for us was a chance to really redefine that relationship and to push forward, as Michael said, towards the beloved community. Park Avenue Baptist was founded as the Fifth Baptist Church of Atlanta shortly after the Civil War. And the neighborhood it began in is what is known as the Old Fourth Ward of Atlanta. And it initially began, like many churches in the South, basically as a Sunday school and education program to teach literacy to children and to use the Bible to do that. Mm-hmm. And so as the church started there in the Old Fourth Ward, it actually moved out of there around the turn of the last century, about 1900, and relocated to this side of the neighborhood, which is about a mile away now presently. But when that move happened, the land that the church had been meeting on in that building was sold to a new African-American congregation that was starting work there. And that was the congregation that actually became Ebenezer over time.
Hmm.
And for myself, we had always sort of known, but I didn't know till about a year ago when we were digging through some historical records where I found from the 1900s an eyewitness kind of account that had been written down where a member cited that they moved out of that part of town, and I quote, because apartments were being built and the Negroes were moving in. And it was just a kind of a pit in my stomach when I read that. We'd always kind of had a hunch, but this was, you know, confirmation there.
Yeah.
And tragically, Park Avenue wasn't alone in that. You know, that was the plight of most white, certainly Baptist churches, as that's the history of the convention. You know, the difference between Northern and Southern Baptist Convention where the Southern wanted to continue to own slaves. And so that tragedy is a part of our history. It's something that personally and in my own sense of calling I'm wrestling with on a daily basis is how do we recognize that our historical institutions have this legacy knit into them. So New Baptist Covenant provides a framework for encountering difference, for moving past that, not just to reconciling, but to really having difficult conversations about how we go forward in true racial justice, not merely reconciling, but even anti-racist. How do we move past this to the vision of the beloved community? And so New Baptist Covenant brought us together. Though there had been sort of these loose connections throughout the year, it gave us the opportunity to say, okay, what work can we do now to impact our communities jointly?
I'd like for whichever one of you wants to begin, that both of you can weigh in on it, talk about the details of what the goals of the New Baptist Covenant are and how those are going to be carried out.
I'm going to throw that one to you, Trey.
All right. I think the innovation of the New Baptist Covenant is that it was a forward-thinking vision laid out by President Carter. Where can we find common ground, and how can we galvanize Baptist forces united under a common purpose, a common cause? And so from President Carter, you know, the clearest divide beyond mere theology was race. So first it was to get everybody in the room together. And then the question was, when we get everyone in the room, what galvanizes us? What do we have in common? What can we agree in covenant to? And so Luke 4, those words of Jesus hearkening back, taking the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, really came to life. And that sort of became the credo to say the Spirit of the Lord is upon not only Jesus, but is upon us as the embodiment of Jesus in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we go out and accomplish the things Jesus talked about that the Spirit enables us to do? How do we preach good news to the poor? What does that actually look like? How do we proclaim recovery of sight to those who are blinded in some way? So when we talk about white privilege or power or any of these sorts of really intricate things, oftentimes folks just don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're living in covenant, we're relating to one another. We're working together. The movement, I think initially it was a meeting, you know, let's get everyone in the same room and then see sort of what happens. And what's grown out of that are these covenants of action. And that's what Park Avenue has entered into with Ebenezer, something Michael and I worked closely on. It's a relationship, a friendship between us that's grown out of that,
mm-hmm.
That largely I have New Baptist Covenant to thank for. But for us, it was, okay, now that we've agreed, all right, we need to be about these things, how do we actually be about that in our communities?
Mm-hmm.
And so for us specifically, it's sort of congealed around children's literacy, making sure that kids are able to read at grade level. Because in our neighborhoods, both mm-hmm. of our neighborhoods, that's the single biggest deterrent mm-hmm. to children advancing in education.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe even for our congregation, it's something that they were excited to get into, because it's something that's just a part of who we are as Ebenezer, because by virtue of the witness of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the world, him and his father and others, that many different types of people come to Ebenezer on a regular basis. And so on one hand, we are historically black church being. On the other hand, we understand how we're situated in the larger perspective of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to say that, it's good to see that, hey, we as a church, we're going to be about what we say, is that we want to see beloved community happen in the world. So being able to partner with our brothers and sisters at Park Avenue to be able to say,
mm-hmm.
this is how we're going to work together to improve the literacy for our children. And I don't think anybody's ever going to be upset when you say we're going to do work together to help advance our children. And interesting enough, we can't take that for granted, too,
uh-huh.
about being intentional about making sure that our children get what they need. And so even just so with our education builders and through our summer camp, we started a summer camp, and it was through that summer camp that we began to do a lot of the work with helping our children with literacy. And so that's what Park Avenue was able to help provide counselors. We provided space and children. And then just over the summer, they're just coming together, interacting, and making sure that over that course of period of time when students aren't in school, that they're getting what they need to keep their literacy skills growing. Because we know that students who aren't reading on a grade level, they're more than likely not to finish high school. They're probably not going to go to college. It's a snowball effect by simply not being able to read on your grade level. And even from just a social historical standpoint, when we talk about just this, even with African Americans at the point in time, how it was illegal for us to learn how to read. And so that right there fundamentally can set you back for so many generations and so many years. And so being able to say that, no, we're going to be intentional about making sure that within these spaces that our kids get what they need so they can be able to advance and have every opportunity for them to be all that they can be.
We've seen widespread flare-ups in racial tensions in this country. The most recent has been in Milwaukee. What is the role of faith communities in moving us beyond the current situation?
The role of faith communities, and a lot of it, is one, to be present. I think what's happening with a lot of the tension that's taking place in the country now, in a lot of respects, you have a generation, they don't feel connected to the faith community for whatever reason. And I know I've heard for some what they just felt like that space hasn't really been an affirming space for a lot of them. And mm-hmm. so for them to be able to go out and express themselves, but a lot of times they haven't found spaces to be able to do these things. And so our churches, for one count, always provide a safe space for people to express how they feel and express honestly how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
I think too often the role that we try to have the church play in this is in a sense to kind of calm everybody down.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of respects, there should be room and space for people to be angry and to be upset. And mm-hmm. if the church allows it to be a space where people can do it and do it in a constructive way, in a
mm-hmm.
sense. Something that Dr. King said before, he says that riots are the language of the unheard.
Mm-hmm.
And typically what happens is that people finally listen once they see a building on fire. But the real question should have been, why weren't people listening before the building caught on fire?
Yeah.
And so it has to move beyond waiting for some property to get torched until people actually pay attention and realize and listen and see that something is going awry. And if church is in the prophetic tradition, we should be able to diagnose and put our finger on it before things come awry and be able to say it. And I see that's where church can have a more prophetic and more helpful role in this, is one, being spaces where people can come and lament and people can come and express their frustration and express their pain. And then two, be places and spaces where we organize to see how do we disrupt the systems that cause these events.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happened in Milwaukee wasn't just simply an isolated incident, but probably it's because you have rampant unemployment in Milwaukee. You have rampant violence in Milwaukee. There are things that are causing the conditions for these things. And if we don't deal with the root of the problem, we keep responding to the symptoms that keep happening
yeah.
instead of dealing with the root cause of a lot of these issues.
Uh-huh.
Very helpful.
Amen, first of all. Everything Michael says is absolutely true. Michael and I
after Ferguson, when everything sort of went off, I was following a little bit on Twitter before the news cameras were there, before the Quick Trip burn, before all of it. I saw a little bit on Twitter, and then I saw Michael had posted some stuff. And so we started texting back and forth, and I said, what's going on? You know, and we were kind of keeping in touch. And exactly what Michael said was sort of the gut-wrenching conclusion we realized. In the chronology of events of what happened in Ferguson, CNN, all the cameras, no one showed up until the QT burned. Until some property was damaged, it wasn't a story. It wasn't a story when they were already in the streets protesting. It wasn't a story when some of the courageous church leaders, not all, but some were out there, you know, trying to mobilize the people. It wasn't a story until something happened, until there was, you know, a bit of salaciousness to it. And so, you know, the unrest we feel like in this present moment, I think, strangely, it may be one of the things that to a certain extent cuts across majority white congregations, majority black congregations and traditions. But, you know, every church wrestles with telling folks what they want to hear so that they'll show up and participate and join the church and bring their children and tithe and preaching the gospel, right? And, you know, as somebody said, you know, when you say you're going to follow Jesus, make sure you remind them that table flipping is an option. You know, that's something Jesus did too. Saying that is to say, you know, the churches, I believe, when we are fulfilling that, we are the ones who help hold the authorities and the powers that be accountable. We're never called to be complicit in the powers that be. That's never what Jesus calls us to. The narrative that we're called to is to respond in peace and in love, but an active love, an intervening love. And so I'm not concerned about the critique some people will say of, oh, well, there's no unifying voice of Black Lives Matter. That's not true. There's no figurehead because they've democratized the process. Or they say, oh, we don't know what they want. No, they've been very clear about the demand. My biggest concern is that most of those folks find no home, no comfort, and no encouragement from most of their native faith communities. Most of the people involved in those movements that I know and have worked with grew up in church. And if they went to their church of origin and said, hey, we're tired of people shooting and killing us. We're tired of these mass inequities. We want you to see this. Please pay attention to this. The church says, oh, we don't want to get political. Their church of origin, sure. At least.
Yeah.
Now, there are churches that are prophetic and that are moving boldly. Ebenezer's, that we aspire to be that space as well. But I honestly think the silence of the church in this era is not dissimilar from the silence of the church in the civil rights movement, which, you know, Dr. King decried as saying that was the most appalling thing, was the silence of the friends, not the vitriol of his enemies.
The Reverend Trey Lyons is pastor of communication and engagement at Park Avenue Baptist Church, and the Reverend Michael Wortham is assistant pastor of college and young adult ministries at Ebenezer Baptist Church, both in Atlanta, Georgia. Theirs are among the other congregations in the nation taking part in President Jimmy Carter's New Baptist Covenant for Racial Reconciliation. Thanks to both of you for taking some time today for us and sharing with us this new and exciting venture. We're thankful for your gift to us today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gaddick.
Well, thank you so much.
Earlier this month, Donald Trump and Marco Rubio spoke at a Florida gathering titled Rediscovering God in America. Organized by anti-gay, far-right dominionist Christian David Lane's American Renewal Project, the event was barely covered in the press, and when it was, the shorthand term evangelical Christians was substituted for the far more sinister nature of the organization. I'm joined now by Frederick Clarkson, senior fellow at Political Research Associates and a longtime observer of the theocratic right. Fred, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks for having me, Welton.
Few things frustrate me as much as statements claiming the religious right is dead as a political force in this country. I don't know how many times I've read that eulogy. I know a lot of these people, and I've seen firsthand the seductive power political influence has over supposedly faith-based agendas. And the folks Trump and Rubio spoke to in Orlando are a fringe of that fringe, although a powerful one. So, Fred, who is David Lane, and what is the American Renewal Project?
Well, David Lane is a longtime Christian right political organizer. He believes that America was founded as a Christian nation and should be restored to that. And by that, he means a nostalgic vision of an America that never was, based on the Christian right's current theocratic views. And he's, for more than a decade, been organizing what he calls pastor policy briefings. And this event in Orlando was part of that series, in which he, all expense paid trips for clergy and spouses in order to present presidential and other elected officials to them, sort of a dog and pony show of potential Christian right political leaders, and also to hear from Christian right historical revisionists like David Barton, who tend to support the Christian nationalist vision. So it's been going on for quite some time, and it's a part of the basic infrastructure of a powerful political movement we call the Christian right, which, as you say, is not to be confused with evangelicals.
Mm-hmm. So talk about the widespread you see of the influence of this group.
Well, we see it as a necessary stop. I mean, people like Donald Trump and Marco Rubio can't wait to speak to these folks, because they understand their political power. But people who have also appeared are all the recent would-be Republican presidential candidates, from Bobby Jindal to Mike Pence. So it's a very important group of people, not just to get their blessing or endorsement, but because these are folks who go out and become the political movement that deliver politicians to power.
Why do you think that there are no consequences for leading politicians cozying up to this kind of group?
There are a lot of reasons. And one is that the media generally tiptoes around the powerful religious organizations, not wanting to come across as anti-religious or to be accused as anti-religious or anti-Christian in particular. Mm-hmm. It's hard to report on because there are potential consequences for reporters. And so it is generally true of mainstream society. Generally, we don't want to believe that it can happen here. We don't want to believe the worst about people. We don't want to believe the worst possibilities for our country. And yet we see a militant, theocratic political movement that's steeped in bigotry towards people of other faiths, towards LGBTQ people, and sometimes even towards our own government. Mm-hmm. And that this is allowed to happen in plain sight with minimum reaction from the rest of us.
Yeah. Tell our listeners the overt agenda of these kinds of people.
There's a broad swath of conservative Christianity that believes that that God has empowered them, God has commanded them to take dominion based on the book of Genesis, then that man shall have dominion over the earth. And they take that quite literally. And so using the Bible as a template and what they call looking through the lens of the Bible, saying, well, if this is the way that the world ought to be, creating a biblical worldview that would permeate all areas of life, including politics and government. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain interpretation of the Bible that says, okay, this is what God commands, and this is where we're going. It would be a much more theocratic society, and it would be governed according to Old Testament biblical law. That doesn't mean that everybody's calling themselves a theocrat, and doesn't mean that come the election of Marco Rubio or Donald Trump that suddenly biblical law would be in the land. I think they see it as a long-term process that would happen unevenly. But nevertheless, we're talking about people who feel empowered that in their lifetimes or in some future lifetimes that America and the world would be a distinctly Old Testament-style theocracy.
Mm-hmm. Now, for people who find that difficult to believe and question the relevance of extremists like David Lane and maybe even the relevance of this kind of conversation, talk about what we've seen their very real impact has been on U.S. policy in past administrations.
Well, I mean, for one thing, we've certainly seen the funding of faith-based organizations, taking money away from government departments and putting them into religious organizations, who are not required to in any way dial back their religious agenda while using taxpayer funds. And more specifically, we've seen at the state level efforts to specifically impede and even to roll back LGBTQ rights, including marriage equality, to try to undermine the intentions of the Supreme Court to bring about this basic equality in public life around marriage. So this is a dynamic movement. To win or lose on particular issues, they are sustained by a transcendent vision to make these things happen. If it's not one battle, it's going to be another battle. Mm-hmm. And the movement is growing rather than declining, at least as I see, and no better evidence than when the leading politicians in the country, you know, seek their support.
Mm-hmm. Fred, you've just published an exhaustive new article titled Dominionism Rising, a Theocratic Movement Hiding in Plain Sight. Give us some of the highlights of that article.
Well, some of the things are things that we've just discussed, how the leading politicians in the U.S. are embracing a dominionist vision. The guy who didn't quite make it this time, Ted Cruz, is certainly the star of this story.
Mm-hmm.
And he, more than almost anyone, has articulated a dominionist vision and surround himself with dominionists, and he's only 45 years old.
He's just off stage, too. He's waiting.
Well, that's right. he's just off stage. And so we also see some highlights about efforts to breed their way into power. And this is the idea that they're not just opposed to abortion and contraception. They believe in large families who can be trained up to be quivers in God, or arrows in God's quiver, to be an army for the future. We see a lot of this kind of natalism among contemporary Pentecostals as well as Catholics. We're seeing the gradual infiltration of dominionist ideas even into dominionist politicians, even into the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. But I think probably the most important thing for people to keep in mind is when we hear people like David Lane or Ted Cruz or Donald Trump talking about religious liberty, it's often a funhouse mirror version of religious liberty that's intended to mask a dominionist political agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't remotely like anything that our listeners would think of as the right to believe or as we will, and to practice our faith and to live out our faith in relative peace with everyone else.
You know, though, I don't know. I'm guessing on this one. I don't know Rubio that well, but I think I know Trump that well, that he showed up at this meeting, my guess is, because someone told him to go there. There were some potential votes. I don't think Trump has shown no evidence that he understands religion enough to know what is an opposition to authentic religion such as dominionism?
That's probably true. There is evidence that he has had relationship with dominionist sorts going back a number of years now and perhaps building what's now become his political campaign. But a lot of these folks understand, again, because they're politically sophisticated, and they know that they're not always going to get leaders who agree with everything that they say.
Mm-hmm.
And they specifically speak, point to the ancient biblical King Cyrus, who was the king of Babylon and had held Jews prisoner for 70 years, and who ultimately freed the Jews and sent them home and helped to build the temple in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So they see someone who is not a person of faith as a person who can be appointed by God to carry out his will and his purposes on earth. Mm-hmm. And so many people in the Dominionist movement say that Donald Trump has a Cyrus anointing, and they're accepting the idea that a guy who's otherwise unacceptable from a Christian point of view could be carrying out God's purposes.
Oh, my goodness. one question. I don't think I've ever asked you this question. You are so good at this, and that means that you study this stuff all the time. You're looking into details. How do you do it, Fred? I mean, how do you do it without getting so cynical that you don't need to be around anybody?
Well, that's a very good question. There's an easy answer to that. I guess we're all constructed differently.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, why I have a particular capacity to digest this kind of material and look at it analytically without getting too upset is a mystery to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you do it, because someone needs to be doing it, and you do it so well. Frederick Clarkson is Senior Fellow at Political Research Associates. His important article, Dominion Rising, A Theocratic Movement Hiding in Plain Sight, is available on the Political Research Associates website, and we're linking to it from stateofbelief.com. Fred, as always, you're very helpful. You may not always be disturbed by what you're finding and sharing, but I'm going to tell you, you know how to disturb a lot of us, and that's a good thing. Thank you for taking the time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Elton. Thank you for the kind words.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that's grown up around State of Belief Radio is active all week long. Be sure to follow us online, on Facebook, on Twitter, and engage in this discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.